I'm Norman. Stephanie's right there.
And we have two internationally celebrated flutists in the studio. And those are Sir James Galway, one of the top musicians of our time, with a dazzling career that has spanned 5 decades and many, many international performances. And his wife, Lady Jean Galway, who performs with her husband. And they are here as part of a gala tour and set of celebrations for Sir James's 70th birthday. Welcome to both of you to the midday.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you with us. Well, tell us, I think, first about the book. I assume you've both been involved in that process.
Yes, I've been the one that would say every morning, Jimmy, don't forget you have to write this book.
An important part.
Well, we didn't get the idea until rather late. And then, of course, the publisher said, he told us in June, we need it for September.
You're kidding.
I'm not. So I spent a lot of time doing it and trying to un-Americanize it.
Un-Americanize it.
Well, the person who was helping me actually amass the stuff and convert the audio into text, Americanized it, said things like, oh, hoisting a few beers with the boys. Well, I never said that in my life. So I had to rewrite the whole thing. But it's very good. I mean, she did a really good job because I couldn't have done it without her, you know.
So instead of hoisting a few beers, how would you phrase that?
Well, I wouldn't because I don't drink.
Well, yeah, that's an important point.
Yeah.
But there were the times in the past, which
there
are also
the
in the book, I have to say.
Uh-huh. I would just say sitting around drinking with the boys, you know.
Now, it would seem just natural, and I can't think of any other way to do it, for this book to be on audio with you reading it, though.
That's a good idea.
Okay, well, get somebody on that.
The title of the book is The Man with the Golden Flute, and you start with your beginnings in Belfast.
Yes, that's right, in a flute band playing a fife sort of thing, and then went on from there to a real flute and then real flute lessons.
At what point did you make that transition from what I might call more folk-oriented music to classical music?
It's hard to say because there's no point that we did it. It just overlapped.
But you took lessons. You started taking lessons, obviously, at one point. You studied with Jean-Pierre Rampal, for one.
Yeah, well, that's going a bit too quick. I studied, first of all, with my Uncle Joe, who gave me the basics of how to play the flute. And then I learned with another guy called Billy Dunwoody, who sort of introduced me generally to a better method of playing the flute. And by that time, I changed from the little flute that I played in the flute band to a regular flute. And we started playing things like the Minuet from L'Arlesia. And
That's a good one.
And the Swan and Beethoven Minuet in G, all those sort of things.
The Nuggets.
Yeah. And then I started to learn with a lady who was a real professional flute player and who'd studied with several people in England. And she was called Muriel Dawn, and she really introduced me to the basics of the real flute playing that I do today.
Was there a point at which you thought this was going to become a national, international career for you?
No. Never thought about it. I mean, and it might have been a good thing because, you know, this is the first thing that gets in the mind of a kid when they pick up the flute. And I think it's the wrong end of the horse, if you ask me.
So, at what point, though, were people saying, you know, you've really got something here that other flutists don't, or did they never say that?
No, they did. And I was the sort of well-kept secret of a lot of people because in London, the Royal Festival Hall had another room called the Queen Elizabeth Hall. And if you rented that, the publicity for that went out on their mailing list to everybody. And we used to do these very snazzy concerts in there, you know, one concert royale from Couperin.
Oh, yes.
And a box sonata, followed in the second half by a French suite or English suite for harpsichord solo, finishing with a B minor sonata of Bach. And these were very snazzy programs for the sort of late 60s, early 70s. And we had a real live gamba player in those days. And the harpsichord player was Colin Tilney, and he was really into it, you know. So I learned from him and another guy called Stanislav Heller all about the decoration of French music, how you do it. And it stuck to me to this day when I read any of these pieces with any of the old music fanatics. They're all amazed that I can actually do it.
The early music performance practices.
Yeah, because there is a definite rule to playing French music, which is quite different from German music and so forth.
Speaking of French music, you'll be performing the Ibert Concerto, Flute Concerto, tomorrow night, and then you and Jeannie will be performing together. What are you going to be playing tomorrow night?
We're playing the Brandenburg Fourth Concerto, and for two flutes and violin. A wonderful violinist from the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra.
Susan,
yes. Mm-hmm. We had a great rehearsal last night in this great concert hall you have here. Boy, that's a gem.
We're fortunate.
Capitol Theater. Yes.
It's just wonderful. We didn't rehearse in the main hall, but we will. And I saw that you have the Christmas lights up. Actually, I see you have the Christmas lights up everywhere here.
That's sort of a statewide phenomenon, I think, because you put them up before the snow flies, and sometimes that means you just leave them up for years at a time.
And being in the northern latitudes the way we are, things are dark right now, pretty early.
You know, I wanted to tell you about this Queen Elizabeth Hall because I gradually had a built-in audience, because then we would do things like the complete box sonatas and things like this, and there was only three of us, and we were renting this hall. Taking the proceeds. No managers involved. And you see, from that point of view, I got quite a reputation even before I went to the Berlin Philharmonic or any of the other Philharmonics.
Yes, because with just the three of you, of course,
you're
one of the most conspicuous players around, right there. Let's hear a bit of both of you in a performance that you recorded for RCA several years ago now, of Domenico Cimarosa. We'll actually have some questions too about how much repertory there is for this two flute combination, but between now and then, the final movement of the Cimarosa two flute concerto in G, featuring our guests today, Sir James and Lady Jeannie Galway, with the London Mozart Players.
Thank you.
Well, you know, there have to be some perks for working in radio. And ours that time around was we heard, yes, the two flutes of Sir James and Lady Jeanie Galway playing there, the Cimarosa, but Stephanie and I also got to hear live the very same two performers playing along with their recording. So we were hearing four flutes while you were hearing two.
Oh, what? Your ears.
Quite a treat.
And the glow of the flutes is just beautiful.
Yes, we're very fortunate. We have beautiful instruments.
Speaking of instruments, you're developing a student flute. Is that what I read?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's being made by Colin Selmer. And it's different from other student flutes because it has a really good scale on it made by Mr. Cooper. It's a copy of Mr. Cooper's scale. And the head joint is to my specifications.
Wow.
And it's all made in America.
Wonderful.
Which is nice because half of them are made in China. And
so it'll be a high-quality student flute with your name on it.
Yeah.
Which is very important because it's really a pity for the kids who are trying so hard to play so well and don't have the muscle tone that we have in later years to be playing these instruments that just don't play. I mean, we pick up student flutes many times, of course, because we work a lot with young players. And they'll be brand new instruments. Their parents have just spent a fortune on them. And we can hardly get the low notes out. Now, if I can't get the low notes out, how can this young child do that? So that is the reason behind this. We really felt that they shouldn't have to wait till they got older and spent $1,000 on a flute. And so my husband has been looking for many years, actually, to find a company that would do this. And we thought the best one also would be an American company. And he really worked very hard on this flute to get the right specifications. And it has a jewel in the headpiece, and they can choose their own color, just like the Galway jewel. And it also has engraving, just like our flutes, and it has his signature on it.
Oh,
and and then with time, we'll be updating our website, or actually getting it moving, where we'll be teaching these young kids on the website to really get them going from the very beginning.
Well, you sound as if you're right on the cutting edge of the whole thing. Tell us about this La Scala event recently.
La Scala.
That was an amazing event. It was organized by the solo flutist of the Scala Orchestra, Davide Formisano, who's a really terrific flute player. And he had this idea to make a celebration for me. So we got together with about eight of the best macho Italian flute players. I tell you, these guys, they play up a storm. They're really great. And we played trios, quartets, duets, you name it, we did it. Marriage of Figaro for four flutes, you got to hear that.
Wow.
I think,
Sounds like it was a lot of fun.
It was, and in at the end, they all got together and played Happy Birthday, which they'd arranged in the style of everybody you can imagine.
Oh, what fun. And I'm told this is the first time that La Scala had such an event for anyone other than a singer.
That's right.
It was very moving, and it was full of young students. And at one point, towards the end of the concert, a banner dropped from the balcony of La Scala that said, "Magic James, you are the best," with a heart that these students had made. And everyone's in shock because this is La Scala.
Yes.
I mean, this isn't just some local place. It was so moving when they did this, and the enthusiasm, and as the concert went on, and we played also a piece together, the boys let me on too. That was very nice. Actually, there I was with all these Italian
macho
flutists, and they were all dressed in black. And my manager came to me at the intermission and says, "Oh, Lady Galway, this is great. That gold gown is going to look so nice against all that black with the boys."
Just in case there's any kids out there who are getting flack for playing a flute, have a look at my website and see these guys play the flute, and they're all in the top orchestras.
Yes.
Well, speaking of top orchestras, you've performed at the Proms with Leonard Slatkin and Herbert von Karajan. I mean, the career is just enormous. What was it like to play with von Karajan?
Great. Very, very good conductor.
So I hear, yes.
No, everything he put his hand to was immediately of a high quality. You know, because he was so experienced. I mean, he grew up doing everything. I mean, for example, when he conducted in Germany just after the war, there was no chorus master, there was no this, no that. So he did the whole thing himself. He did the director producing did the chorus, conducted the orchestra, so he knew the whole thing. So several decades on, with all that experience, it was no big deal for him to produce Tristan and Isolde in Salzburg.
Sure.
Now, you played with Berlin Philharmonic for several years.
Yeah, six.
About, what, 69 to 75 or something like
right.
that? How did it pass between you and Herbert von Karajan when you said, I think I'm going to go out on a solo career? How did that conversation go?
He got me into his room on the first day of the last season I played, and it was in Luzern, actually. And he said, I hear, Jimmy, you're going to leave. I said, yes, I'm thinking of it. He said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I want to pursue a solo career. He said, well, if you don't do it, you'll never know if you could.
That's enlightened.
Right.
So
okay.
That was enough for me to get my teeth into it.
Mm-hmm.
That worked
and then,
out.
Of course, when it came to the crunch, he freaked out.
So what were your first steps as a solo career flutist then? How did you approach it?
Well, I had already been doing all these little things that I explained to you.
Yes.
And even the day before my audition, I played the Ebert Concerto with the Welsh Orchestra live on the radio. And, I mean, I'd been doing all these sort of things, playing with various orchestras up and down England. And when I left the orchestra, we did about 120 concerts in a year. I mean, some of them must have been for nothing, you know, because we had to get the word out. Uh-huh. We had to show them that I could really do this.
But, Jimmy, I think what is really memorable, and I believe you talk about this in your book, is that because you did that and because you had such a reputation in the UK, that promoters like Ernest Fleischmann, who had been the manager of the London Symphony, who actually brought him to the London Symphony when he just had signed with the BBC Symphony. But Ernest was then the manager of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, so when he heard that James had just gone and sold out the Albert Hall 3 days in the trot, immediately got him over to America, and the next thing he did was sell out the Hollywood Bowl, and that was the beginning of his U.S. career in 1978. And us flutists, I was then a student, a budding student, and I remember this. We all remember this, him coming to America. We were all just waiting because he was the man with that sound and that golden touch.
Why do you think, maybe it's not true, maybe it's just a perception on my part, that there were not really world-known flutists before, I'm going to say, Ron Paul? You know, you have violinists, obviously, you have pianists, the Paderewskis, and the Paganinis, of course. But in terms of a really world-class flute superstar...
Well, there has never been any real school of flute playing. For example, you know, Heifetz and all these guys came from one definite Russian school, and they could all play fantastically. You see, you go to one teacher here, and he said, oh, don't do that, you'll sound like Galway.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, imagine sounding like me. What a thing.
Yes, what a curse.
And then they teach the students how to play like them, and them are stuck in a class all day just teaching, and they, when they teach, they're not teaching from a point of view of having done it. It's all a whole theory
rather than performance.
That's right.
With
and
an audience
I teach
involved.
The Ebert Concerto, I've played it, and the Nielsen Concerto, I played the Mozart D major 2 years ago, I played it I think 27 times in 2 months. So, you see, you gain a tremendous amount of experience and you really know this piece inside out. Whereas a regular teacher cannot provide these...
Insights
for a student. And, you know, there's an awful lot of jealousy goes on with this one from here and the other one from New York.
And,
you see, so the kids don't stand a chance because they're already killed by the jealousy and the way they're brought up.
I think also, Jimmy, what we have in America is that this band system, which I know, well, on the college level is very hard for the kids who want to be professionals or soloists. And because we come into contact with them, they'll say, well, I have to do band, I have to do this. It takes so much away from their time of practice. But for myself, being a student, I was brought up in the New York school system, which had a very good school system, but I was taught by a clarinetist.
Oh, so?
Because to have an education degree, you have to play several instruments.
That's right.
So already there was no school. And by the time I got my first really good teacher, I was 16. And it was the first time I really learned about certain things, like really vibrato and really about double tonguing and everything. And she could show. She was a student at Kincaid's, and she could play, and she was a professional flutist in an orchestra. And she had a great school and turned me right around. And she was the one, thank God for me, that pushed me to go to New York and says, you must go to New York. You must go to a place where you will hear music all the time, and you'll be playing music all the time. And if it hadn't been for that. And I feel bad for these kids that are sit in this middle of this confusion, and there is, and more what we see is we meet these kids, I say to them, come to the James Galway Masterclass. There's not a question. Go to the best. And they say, well, you know, I'm going to my teacher's class. Well, you study with your teacher all year, but so they're already in this manipulation, and because, you know, a young student
can't.
But the other
thing impressionable about string players is they don't have band.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're way streets ahead technically and musically. Because, you see, another difficulty we have with the flute is each flute teacher is trying to produce a little James Galway by the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
So they involve them in playing difficult pieces, which they can't really play. Because at that age, they don't have the lung capacity,
sure,
the breathing capacity to do it. And they miss out on playing all the things like Air on the G String, the Beethoven Minuet in G,
the Swan,
all that sort of stuff, because these little pieces have beautiful examples of how to play music. Whereas if you're involved in playing the Carmen Variations, you're not going to do much about music because you'll be too busy flapping your fingers around.
And breathing somewhere in there.
But the exciting thing, and the last thing so we can get on to other things, is that what we're seeing right now is a very high level of young players at the age of 13 to 16. And for us, this is very exciting because of our school and our work with young ones. For many years, it's been frustrating. But just recently, these 15-year-olds that came to our class in Switzerland, one of them from America, from Indiana, Emma, Indianapolis, wonderful, with the most beautiful, very special kind of playing in her sound. And then the other day I heard someone in Singapore, 13 years old. And so we have this outreach program where we can bring these kids through funding over to our class and get them set up, which is very good. And so it is exciting that all of a sudden there's a new group, all 15-year-olds, and a lot of the teachers are saying this now. So maybe finally his influence and the influence of our colleagues is coming through, and that we will have a really good flute school.
Well, we'll look forward to that.
The two of you maintain that in Switzerland.
Yes.
That, but we also give classes wherever we are, basically, and have contact with the young students. But yes, our school is in Switzerland in the summer.
And maybe we'll hear the two of them playing live.
Well, they have the music out. They have the flutes out. I think that's a good sign. We can pressure them that far. And let us do that in just a moment, if we may. We have a couple other things to do. And, of course, it makes it more suspenseful anyway. So back in a moment with our quiz question and also with Sir James and Lady Jeannie Galway.
We have two flutists, two beautiful flutes. And what would you like to play?
Well, we're going to play a movement from a duet by Schulz. It's a German composer.
Johann Christian.
Yeah, just in case you get him mixed up with all the other
Schulz.
Schulz.
Schulz from the...
Hogan's
the
Heroes.
Sergeant. Schulz.
Yeah. Schulz.
And what movement are we playing?
First movement.
Okay. Thank you.
movement by Johann Christian Schultz.
It's just beautiful.
You are so experienced, obviously, as performers, both of you, that it probably doesn't make any difference, but I'll ask anyway. When you play for, Prince Edward in Buckingham Palace, or you play for the Empress of Japan, does that make any difference who's in the audience when you have celebrities like that?
No.
No, well, you just have to remember to do the protocol before it starts. That's very important. As far as performing, no. It's always, you go into the concentration phase before you walk on there, and you just remember to bow before the Empress and to look in the right direction if you don't know where the royal box is. Those little things. But no, it's a very special feeling, though. It's very, very special. I remember at one of our Christmas concerts at the Royal, at the Barbican, I think it was, or the Festival Hall, one of these, Princess Di was there. And this was very, very special. And I remember seeing her and thinking, this is really nice. And meeting her afterwards and everything.
Well, the career for both of you takes you around the world, and particularly this year seems to have been just packed full to celebrate your 70th birthday.
Yeah, that was my idea. I think it was one of my worst ideas. We're never home this year. But I wanted to show the legacy of James Galway. I'm one of my husband's biggest fans, and being a flutist and growing up being a fan of his since I was in my teen years. And I see all he does in ways that are not written down on paper, and his generosity with fans, and always time for a young player who comes to the concert, and always during rehearsals and not being stressed and having time just to greet someone and to write. He writes a lot to the kids and things. And I think this is a very special quality, and to show one of the most influential musicians of our times, but also someone who has made this instrument so famous and always been a good example to that.
Well, and in addition to the book, you've also released a DVD and
yes.
a CD as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah.
And you've commissioned new works.
Yes. I've sort of stopped that at the minute.
Well, the Adamo piece.
Oh, yeah, we have one piece which you haven't played yet by Mark Adamo. And I was hoping to play it in Buffalo with Joanne Falletta, but the concert got cancelled.
Ouch. But we'll
find. I get cancelled out of it. Maybe it'll be cheaper.
But we'll find some time. And we are talking to some other composers about doing some things. I'm talking at the minute to, I shouldn't say. You'll see when they come out.
Always have something in the air there going, uh-huh. of course.
Yeah. We've been focusing mostly on the classical repertory, but you've also played with the Chieftains. You appeared with Pink Floyd.
Sure. Produced one LP that was green. I remember that we have that one around here somewhere. Literally, the vinyl itself was green.
Ah. Uh-huh.
Must have been one of the Chieftains. Actually, Jimmy's playing with Paddy Maloney and the boys, as he says, in 2 weeks in Ireland. Paddy's coming on his birthday concert, and so that should be a lot of fun, huh,
yeah.
Jimmy?
Yeah, it's always fun with Paddy. I mean, he's a really great player.
Do you shift gears in terms of your performance and how you prepare for a concert like that, from classical and Irish traditional music, popular music?
With the Irish traditional music, you have to really almost memorize it, because these guys don't play with any music, and they have a special way of doing things. They say, okay, this is an A, B, and C deal.
Okay.
We're going to start with the fiddle playing A, and then he'll play that twice, and the second time somebody else will join in on a flute, and then we go to B, and the two people will play B, and the third one will join in at B, and you have to remember. They remember this whole
all
stuff.
These patterns.
Yeah, they're so used to doing it, they memorize a whole evening of stuff. Who plays at A, B, and C, and which tune?
Shall we hear some of that? You with the Chieftains?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sir James, okay, these are three hornpipes.
Thank you.
you don't really have cues exactly. You just have to kind of go once you get started on something like that.
Yeah, well, we practice it before, but
that's all kind of out the window.
I usually write it all down, and the guys are all laughing at me because I have to do that.
So, speaking of the Irish influence, how important is that to you, and what are your earliest memories of music in Northern Ireland?
Well, I used to hear this music all the time every morning because we'd have the 7 o'clock news, and then we'd be followed by Irish rhythms with a guy called David Curry and his band. And they would play this stuff as I was getting up to go out to school. And my dad would go off to the shipyard or whatever he did. So we'd hear that. And then that was sort of it for the day, because we never heard much of this music on the radio. I mean, I didn't listen to radio all that much, but that's what I got in the mornings. And then when I got into music, I used to listen to the Promenade concerts and hear really spectacular performances, you know, for example, Shearing playing the Sibelius, and, you know, live. And it was very good to the Promenade concerts for a little guy like me.
What about in a more informal setting? Just, you know, I mean, I guess you were a little young at that point for the pubs or, you know, anything like that that would have a lot of this music. But what sort of, I mean, culturally speaking in Ireland, what kind of venues would you have for Irish music?
Well, I didn't get involved in it, you see, because I didn't ever play Irish music. I only took up the, you know what, you know, the first time I played the tin whistle was after all six box and others, we didn't have any encores. So we played a slow moving one of the sonatas again. The public were jumping and screaming. So I said to the guys, "Hey, listen, I'm playing my tune on the tin whistle," and the harpsichord player said, "Oh, you can't do that." So, wait. So I did, and it brought the house down.
I would think. Do you travel with a tin whistle usually?
Well, I hadn't happened to have one at that concert.
Oh, what's that?
But not, this is a very expensive tin whistle.
It doesn't look like tin to me. What is it, an expensive tin whistle made of?
Rosewood and gold trimmings.
That's beautiful.
Mr. Abel. He makes very good wooden flutes and tin whistles.
What does it sound like?
Well, like this.
Applause. I don't know. I keep having the sense that if you were just to walk into a room with one of those, that'd be the sort of thing that you'd likely to just play naturally.
Not me, because I haven't got the repertoire to do that. You know, these guys have millions of these tunes, and it's like me, I know all the Beethoven symphonies, I know all the Brahms symphonies, I know several Bruckner symphonies, I know all the Schubert symphonies, but Irish music I don't know.
Yeah, but the little ones that you know, you do really well, James.
Yeah.
You've had many, many recording projects. Do you have anything, you just finished this big 70th birthday DVD and CD. Anything in the hopper for future recordings?
No, but recently in Japan, Sony in Japan suggested that I play with a German harpsichord player. So maybe I might get into doing that. They just sent me about 10 records of them playing everything.
Sounds like they're interested.
A little bit.
You know, they think that if I used a different harpsichord player, it would be a different input and a different sort of vibe. And it might be true.
Do you see that in your own playing?
Well, I don't know. I have to meet this guy first, and I have to listen to see what he does and all that sort of thing. And we have to see if we get on. Because when I recorded the first Bach sonatas with Sarah Cunningham, I mean, she's a real big time gamba player, and I invited her to my home for a week, and I said, "Sarah, listen, we're going to practice these things, and if you don't like it, if it really gets on your nerves, you can say no." But by Wednesday, she was all ready to do it, so we got around to recording it with Sarah and with Philip Moll, my piano and harpsichord player.
Mm-hmm.
A bit of Bach, we call that.
A bit of Bach.
Yes. Lovely stuff, too.
We should mention that Lady Jean and Sir James Galway are here because they're in the midst of this wonderful tour in honor of his 70th birthday, and they'll be appearing with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra tomorrow night in Madison at Overture Hall in the Capitol Theater. The performance is sold out, however, so tickets are no longer available. But there is a DVD and a CD released by Sony BMG called James Galway Celebrates 70. It's a collection of personal favorites and many other ways you can connect with the music of Sir James and Lady Jeanie. This is the Midday on Wisconsin Public Radio, and Norman and James are passing books back and forth and autographing, and it's marvelous.
So, and you're doing a book signing. I think we can shamelessly plug that. Or is this part of a tour, or is you just happen to be in town with the book, Sir James?
The latter.
So, well, so this is a special,
that's right,
special thing.
Yeah. He'll be
do we know where that's happening?
We do. That'll be happening at Barnes & Noble in Madison, Wisconsin, on the west side of town, and that's at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
And the name of the book is The Man with the Golden Flute, Sir James, a Celtic Minstrel. What prompted you to subtitle it that?
Oh, we beat a few names around, and that one got the most votes.
Well, I'm sure that'll work very well. Now, before everybody takes off for their next commitments, we want to hear one more of your recordings in which both of you are performing, and this is the Mozart Rondo alla Turca.
Oh, yeah.
A fun piece. Let's see if they play along with that one, too, live in the studio. We'll let you know right after this. Thank you. That, by the way, was the Rondo alla Turca, originally for a harpsichord or keyboard by Mozart. And they're featuring our guests today, Sir James and Lady Jeannie Galway.
In a lovely arrangement by one of your friends, you were saying.
Hey, David Overton.
Yeah. Mm.
David did all my Christmas records, if you have those on the station.
We do have some.
He did all of those arrangements.
Oh. And yes, I remember them quite well, actually. They're lovely stuff. They get play. A pleasure having you with us, Sir James and Lady
Jeannie.
Thank you.
It was a real honor.
Shall I sign that?
Oh, a signed copy of the CD.
Of course.
Okay, what a wonderful treasure trove.
And in parting, Sir James mentioned just a little while ago that he actually was flutist for a performance of Anthony and Cleopatra on stage. It sounds like that would have been quite the costumes themselves, I guess, were worth the price of admission, but there were grapes involved, too, you tell me.
I didn't hear that one, James.
He'll tell you later. Well, we will look forward to your performance Saturday night, a sold-out performance with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, and maybe you'll hear more about that after the fact.
Our guests this afternoon on the Midday have been Sir James and Lady Jeannie Galway. Thank you very much. We're grateful to have had you this afternoon.
Pleasure.
Thank you.